Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hi, Mark. How are you? It's been some time.
It has been a minute, as we say here in Atlanta. Mona, I am absolutely giddy about today's guest. Today, joining us on EB5 Investment Voice, we have the Ira Kurzban. Mr. Kurzban is a founding partner of the law firm of Kurzban, Kurzban, Wagner, Tizell, and Pratt, located in Miami, Florida. Considered one of the country's leading immigration attorneys, Mr. Kurzban has been extensively involved in the EB5 program since its inception. He was lead counsel in Chang versus U.S., the most significant decision to date involving the immigrant investor program. He's also currently litigating a wide variety of EB5 cases on behalf of immigrant investors. Over the course of his career, Ira has received a number of distinctions for his work in immigration law. Now, all these distinctions are world-class, and to pick just one of these to read would almost be a knock at the other ones, and they're all great. If you don't know Ira Kurzban already, we'll go ahead and put those distinctions up on the website. Chances are, if you're listening to this show, you know the immigration and the EB5 industry, you already know him and some of the work he's done.
Yeah, Mark, you know what we nickname Ira? LL. It stands for Living Legend.
Living Legend. You know, he says on here, considered one of the country's leading immigration attorneys. I bet you if I were to ask 50 immigration attorneys across the nation to list their five top most known and influential immigration attorneys, I imagine his name would show up more than anybody else's. So he's very humble. He's considered one, maybe one of the highest. So Ira, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mark. And thank you, Mona. It's always a pleasure to be with Mona, who's, in my view, one of the very, very best EB5 and one of the very best lawyers in the country. So it's an honor for me to be here.
Ira, thank you. Thank you so much. Well, Ira, we have so much to discuss. First, I'm just going to go straight into it. As again, I'm very mindful of the fact that you have given us some of your precious time. EB5, it's never been so popular, but we still don't have any legislative fix. I know that you were not very supportive of the last bill.
Yes. First of all, the question is, when will we have a legislative fix? I'm not sure we will ever have a legislative fix. There are too many competing interests. As you know, the way the process unfolded, I think the last time around, everyone waited to the very end to present this bill to the Democrats. And I think ultimately there was not a consensus on some very important issues, particularly and obviously on the issue of targeted employment areas and how they should be treated. The bill has a number, the last go around of the legislation, the one that everyone thought was going to pass but did not, I thought had a number of very, very serious problems. The first and actually major problem that no one seems to be paying any attention to is the question of imputed liability for regional centers. And I think that's also, by the way, in the regs, and it may be even stronger in the regulations.
Ira, you're absolutely correct, because even on the Public Policy Committee, some of the issues that had concerned you, including that of imputed liability, was just never even raised by these committees.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had a lot of experience with this in the J exchange visitor area, where sponsors by regulation are really subject to imputed liability of their subcontractors and even people who are subcontractors of the subcontractors. What that means, I think, for the listening audience is if you do nothing wrong, if you are the regional center, for example, and you've done everything right, and when you learn of a problem, you jump on it right away and try to do something, but someone down the road, for example, the agent, has made a misrepresentation to an investor, or someone else has made a misrepresentation, the way that this statute and regulations are structured, they in effect make you responsible for it.
Wow.
So that's a big problem.
That really is. Well, the other good thing is that I know you've just mentioned that they are mentioned in the regs. The same, is the imputed liability also mentioned in the regs?
Yes, the imputed liability, I think, is even clearer in the regs in a way than it is in the statute. This could have a very, very powerful effect because now you're giving regulators the tools to engage in disbarment or have very serious fines leveled against people and against entities. So I think someone needs to take a very careful look at that aspect of it. And that's one part. The other part, as you know, Mona, because we've talked about this before, is judicial review.
Yeah.
In 1996, Congress passed the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, and they stripped the federal courts in about 17 different ways of suing the federal government or immigration agents if they did something that was improper or flat out wrong, for example. So what happens when you give impunity to government officials? I think we're seeing part of that in a number of the areas that we practice in, not only EB-5, but other areas where the agency is just engaged in arbitrary and capricious conduct, but you cannot sue them because of certain provisions in the 1996 Act. The proposed legislation here virtually does the same thing. It insulates from judicial review most serious actions of the agency, and particularly actions that are directed toward the regional centers, the people who are responsible for running the regional centers, persons responsible for representing individual investors. So the government can engage in sanctions, and the ability to correct those sanctions through legislation is highly circumscribed in the proposed legislation. And that was one of the areas that we felt should be brought to the attention of the regulators and should be brought to the attention of members of Congress. And that I had hoped that organizations like IIUSA and our own immigrants list would take a strong position on those because of the consequences.
Again, Ira, I will say that a lot, there's so much out there that unfortunately a lot of these provisions really have escaped some of the scrutiny. Only just a couple of days ago, there's a wonderful white paper out there by the NYU Stern professors, and they have really honed in on a lot of the issues. But I don't recall even in their paper seeing anything relating to judicial review or indeed imputed liability.
Well, you know, the difficulty, Mona, is that I think people don't think about litigation until they need litigation.
Yeah.
They don't think about things like imputed liability until they receive that notice that they're being fined for tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars for something that someone else did. In a way, it's not surprising. I mean, in the 1996 law, there was really kind of radio silence on the judicial review provision, stripping judicial review. There was very little discussion about it. You know, there were, in fact, there was very little discussion about anything in 96, which is one of the problems that we are suffering through today with things like mandatory detention and other issues. But from the standpoint of EB-5, what I envision is the same kind of thing happening, which is, people don't really feel the effects of this until they are subject to arbitrary action by the agency. And for the first time, they learn that they cannot sue.
Well, don't you think that too much has perhaps been given over to the SEC? Too much authority?
Yeah, I think the issue on the SEC, of course, is, you know, I think a totally separate issue. They may take the view that they, you know, coming into the game quite late. That is that they didn't have the opportunity before to challenge a number of these kinds of practices. It is problematic, but on the other hand, the question is the failure, in my view at least, to regulate some of the really bad practices. You know, from a litigation standpoint, and we obviously do a lot of that, we have seen over the years some of the really bad practices you know, within the EB5 community. And they basically went unchecked until the SEC came in. Now, you know, there's a good and bad aspect of it. Ultimately, they're there to try and protect, in my view, trying to protect the investors. And so the question, as in many of these situations, is where do you draw the line? Sometimes there's clearly overreaching and they're engaged in battling in programs that they probably shouldn't be involved in. And then there are others where I feel there's been out and out fraud and no one's really stepped up, or they've stepped up too late.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Ira, do you think that's the crux of it? You know, where to draw the line? Obviously, we don't have a legislative fix and really we're trying to reach a legislative compromise, but is it where to draw that line and get the majority of the people agree, you know, for the benefit of the most while protecting all? Is that what's making this so hard?
I think what's really making it hard is the battle over the TEAs and who should have control over that. Okay. And I think the other part that makes it difficult is how much authority do you really want to give organizations like the IPO and USCIS to make determinations on some of these issues?
I agree. I've actually been guilty of writing articles. I did a joint article with Lori Rosenberg. She was a former BIA judge on overreaching here, exactly in this particular context.
And I think what happens is they come up with what I would regard as some bizarre interpretations of their own regulations.
Yeah.
That in a way is kind of pushing the envelope, and they're doing it for other purposes. To me, the classic example, and Mona, you are very familiar with this, is when they turned around and said, when a young person gets a loan from the bank based on their family's collateral, that they don't regard that as an investment in the program. They don't regard that as an investment in cash. So what are they saying? If I go out and get a loan and I have my $500,000 and I give it to a project that maybe Mona helped to structure, and it's a good project, there's no problems with it. But in order to get that $500,000 from the bank, because I'm a younger person, I need my parents to use their home as collateral. Under immigration's kind of new interpretation, and that's an interpretation that they've only had in the last 3 or 4 years, they have said that doesn't constitute a cash investment. Well, of course it's cash. What they're really saying is because your parents put up the collateral, even though you personally got the loan, it's not really your money. And that's ludicrous. I mean, that just is contra normal business practice.
Yeah, agreed.
So, you know, what we've done now in 2 or 3 cases, we've sued USCIS and said, look, your own regulation says cash. And what you're really trying to regulate is the source of funds, but you have the right to regulate the source of funds separately. You just want to do it kind of the cheap and easy way, which is to say, whenever anybody else puts up collateral, we're not going to check those source of funds. We're just going to say it's not cash. Well, that just is, you know, so blatantly contrary to the regulations. And, you know, we've been litigating that issue and some of these other issues where they're, you know, kind of pushing the envelope, issues about when is money at risk or not. Their overinterpretation, for example, of matter of Izumi, which is one of the major decisions in this area, basically saying nothing is at risk.
Yeah.
Under the interpretation of matter of Izumi, we've cut that back in a very recent decision in another case, the Chang case, a second Chang case. So I think the real problem to me isn't so much the SEC, really, as it is the USCIS's either misinterpretation of their own regulations or their overzealousness. As soon as they hear the word fraud or they hear some problem, and the question is how to balance the SEC and USCIS's reaction to what the SEC is doing. For example, we have cases where the SEC has come in, the project has been restructured, the project is going forward, and yet USCIS jumped the gun, and as soon as the SEC came in, they decided to terminate the regional center. And on one of those, they eventually backtracked administratively, but we're in federal court on another case. And this is what I meant about Mona going back to the and Mark going back to the issue of judicial review, whether or not we'd be able to do that if this bill had passed, I think would be quite another issue. I don't think it was so clear that we'd still be able to sue on the theory that the agency was overzealous in terminating a regional center.
Ira, I'm not sure if you're aware, but on April the 5th of this year, Grassley, Goodlatte, and Leahy sent a letter to the Trump administration urging the Trump administration to finalize the EB-5 regs. We'd already heard that the regs were with the OMB. So we have on the grapevine heard that they are going to come out very shortly and perhaps before the end of this month is out. Do you think the regs would actually help or worsen the situation?
Well, obviously the dollar amount is a big factor.
Yes.
You know, they're talking about a very large jump from the 500,000 to 1.2, I believe, or
1.3 and 1.8. But there is a likelihood that that amount is going to go down. I mean, I can't think in my wildest dreams that USCIS are actually serious about 1.8 and 1.3. But then you never know.
Right. You never know. And they're doing it, they say, based on a calculation of, you know, the increase in the cost of living and so forth from the time that the legislation was first proposed. And, you know, in the legislative history, of course, there were many who wanted to start it at a million and 2 million, not at 500,000 and a million. I actually think that they may stick to those numbers or stick to numbers that are pretty close to those numbers. And that, of course, is going to have an impact here on the program. I mean, the other thing that really troubles me, and we're about to launch litigation on this, is how they're treating derivatives in the backlog, which they really did not address in the regulations. We believe the agency had the authority and that DHS has the authority and not to count derivatives. We sent a letter on behalf of myself, the former chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee, and four of the former general counsels saying that the agency has the authority to not count derivatives if they want to, because, as you know, we have a huge backlog. The backlog is almost wholly attributed to derivatives. If we weren't counting the spouses and children in the visa count, the 10,000 visa count, we'd have a very, very different picture. So they really haven't done anything, I think, to address that, which seems to me to be a very important issue. And then, as I said before, the, you know, this notion of imputed liability, I think, is very serious. On the other hand, you know, there are some positive aspects to it. I think the industry does have to recognize that there has to be more policing of what's going on, because obviously over the last year or two, particularly since the SEC has gotten involved, we've seen a good deal of fraud uncovered, a good deal of sloppy practices. You know, that's why in this field, you need good lawyers like Mona and others who are going to advise people properly about what their documents look like. You know, I am always shocked when we do this litigation, when we look at the documents and we go, what were these lawyers thinking? You know, the PPM says one thing, the business plan says something that contradicts the PPM, the investors agreement says a third thing. And of course, the agency, you know, correctly picks up on that. And sometimes those things are a mask for fraud. So I think this is going to make people pay a little bit more attention.
I agree. By the way, on the issue of derivatives, I know Julia Harrison did mention that the USCIS were considering putting into abeyance some of those cases, basically just holding some of the cases which are going to go into severe retrogression, just putting them aside until as long as they possibly can. So let's see if they actually go ahead and do that.
Well, that would be a great help, certainly. As you know, a lot of this program is driven by investors who want to help their children. And there is a significant age out problem in these cases. So, yeah, I agree. I think that would be a very positive step.
So anyway, Ira, I know we discussed a lot about EB5. This is an EB5 podcast, but you are also involved in something more exciting and something that I feel that really has your heart, the immigrants list.
Thank you. You know, in 2006, a group of immigration lawyers started Immigrants List. And why did we start it? Because it became clear that as a result of the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, our hands were tied in many ways. And Mona, you know this, I think, perhaps better than many people. There's something called the 3- and 10-year bar.
Yes.
Prior to 1996, if a person was illegally in the U.S. and you wanted to help them and do the right thing, you would petition for them as a sponsor, what we call labor certification. And the penalty was that they would have to go abroad, pick up their visa, and return to the United States, but that they would get their green card. And the employer would be doing the right thing. He would make somebody who was out of status legal in the U.S. And this was true of residents as well, a lawful permanent resident who married somebody who was out of status. They would just go home, get their green card, and come back. In 1996, they passed a provision in the Republican-controlled Congress that said if you were here unlawfully for more than 6 months and you left for any reason, including to get your green card, you couldn't come back for 3 years. And if you were unlawfully here for a year and you left, you couldn't come back for 10 years. So one of the things that this 3- and 10-year bar has done has really trapped people in the U.S. You know, I find it ironic that our Republican friends talk about the 11 million undocumented people. Well, if you're an immigration lawyer, what you know is many of those, easily more than half, are created because of the 3- and 10-year bar, because those are people who before 1996 could have easily become residents of the U.S. And then there are many other provisions that I won't go into, including how they narrowed waivers and made it impossible for people who are married to American citizens to become residents. So in 2006, after putting a tissue box on my desk and watching people in my office crying and saying, "What do you mean? I'm an American citizen. How can you tell me my husband's going to be detained until he's deported and has no relief, even though he's been here since he's 5 years old?" We decided to do something, and we started Immigrants List. And Immigrants List is both a C4 organization, which is an educational organization, and a political action committee, which is a committee designed to support candidates who are pro-immigration. And since 2006, about 70% of the people we've supported have won elections, some of those in very close elections where I think we made a difference. For example, Catherine Cortez Mastos, who won in Nevada 2 years ago in a very close election. I think our help and what we've basically done is help in minority communities, in the Hispanic community and the Asian American community, by running ads and doing other things. And the PAC has supported these candidates financially. And, you know, most people don't like the idea of PACs, and I have not always been a big fan of it. But when you realize that tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars are being spent on the other side to come up with the kind of harebrained things we're now seeing in immigration from the White House on down, we felt we needed a PAC, and we're the largest pro-immigration political action committee in the country, and we're not that large. But it is, as you said, a passion of mine. I really feel there needs to be another view presented to the American public. So just 2 weeks ago, we ran our first ads on CNN in Washington, D.C., supporting the DACA kids and supporting a more just and a more sensible and a more rational policy on immigration than building a wall for, you know, $20 billion or whatever it's going to cost to try and deal with the really central issues. That is, how do you keep America safe, not take jobs away from Americans, but at the same time recognize that we do need people in the U.S., that we should be promoting things like EB-5. For example, this administration has decided to end the entrepreneurial regulations that came out that were designed to encourage people who want to be innovators to come to the United States, get paroled in, and create jobs for Americans. We all know who practice in this field that L's, E's, H's, other visas are now in jeopardy because of the interpretations that are being given. And in my view, the idea of grinding everything to a halt. So we need another voice. And Immigrants List has tried to be that other voice by supporting candidates who are really pro-immigration. For example, one of the candidates that we're supporting this year is Beto O'Rourke, who's running for the Senate in Texas. He introduced a bill that would have generous waivers for this 3- and 10-year bar, have an end, for example. We have a statute. There's no statute of limitations in immigration. So, for example, a person who committed a crime 40 years ago has had a clean record in the last 40 years is still barred from entering the U.S. So Beto has introduced the bill. He's very strongly supportive of immigration issues. And that's what we're doing. As you know, Mona, in this week coming, we're having the Michael Maggio Awards.
Yes.
Michael was a very prominent, very famous immigration lawyer who passed away, unfortunately, too young. And the award is named after him. And we give it to a member of Congress or members who have supported immigration. This year, we're going to be honoring the senator from Hawaii, who has been very strongly supportive of DACA, and a member of the House, Ms. Jayapal from Washington, who has been an outspoken critic of the administration's policies on immigration. So I hope you'll be there. I hope you'll come, and people are certainly welcome.
I would love to be there. It's a very noble cause. Unfortunately, I'm going to be in Russia at that same time. But next year, for sure, I'm going to block out that date. But the Michael Maggio Awards are really it's a noble enterprise, Ira, and I applaud you all for this.
Thank you.
So, Ira, it sounds like there's been a lot of work with Immigrants List for good reason since 2006. But let me ask you, who can be a member of Immigrants List, and, well, why should our EB5 listeners be interested in it?
Well, first, anyone can be a member. You do not have to be a citizen or even a resident to be a member. To give a contribution to the C4, you do not have to be a citizen or a resident. To give a contribution to the Political Action Committee, you do have to be a citizen or a resident. But anyone is welcome to become a member of Immigrants List. You can just go to www.immigrantslist.org, that's S with an S, immigrantslist.org or .com, either one, and you'll see the kind of work that we're doing right now. I think the EB5 community should be involved. We've had a lot of donations from members of the EB5 community for several reasons. One is that many of those people are the same people who practice immigration law. We have a lot of immigration lawyers who are involved in EB5, but they're also involved in many of these other issues. Secondly, we have been working toward trying to support legislation like that would support basic due process issues like this issue of judicial review. And we've worked with the American Immigration Lawyers Association, IIUSA, and other organizations in the process of getting this legislation or trying to get a fair legislation, I should say, through the Congress. And if not, trying to pressure the agency to come up with fairer regulations. And, you know, the way that I've done that is what I've talked about today, which is judicial review and the issue of imputed liability.
Ira Kurzban, thank you so much for coming on EB5 Investment Voice. And thank you for so much you have done and continue to do for the immigrant community.
Mona, thank you very much for being on. I hope I wasn't too long-winded.
Never. No. We could carry on listening to you for another podcast hereafter. Thank you.
And hopefully we get that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.